the other day I was wandering around outside, and actually I wasn't wandering, I was coming back here from BART, and I had the thought, I thought, well, I'm hard to hear at all. And then I thought, well, actually, we're hard to hear at all. And I thought, well, maybe that'll be the Dharma talk. Just say, we're hard to hear at all. And see, what if we were just to sit with that for a minute and see if that does it make any sense to anybody? Sense is perhaps the wrong word. Does that resonate with our experience at all to say that? We're hard to hear at all. That partly came to my mind because I once was talking to Isan about Suzuki Roshi. And he said, towards the end of his life there, before he got sick, he said, he was hardly there at all. Not meaning he wasn't around, meaning his presence was almost transparent. So I'm not suggesting my presence is almost transparent, but when we perceive ourselves with a kind of a steady mind, we begin to see that there's actually not much there. And that our impression of our own solidity is just that, an impression. And it leads us into spaces such as the melancholy Dane, who I believe said, oh, that this too solid flesh, that's Hamlet, right, would thaw, melt, and resolve itself into a dew. So, spaces where we feel the weight of our existence as though it were, you know, kind of like something squashing us. And because of our habits of mind, we don't actually look at that very carefully and quietly and see what's actually there. And the more we look, the more we realize, as Buddha said, there isn't anything that isn't simply the flow of impressions of various kinds. And once you start to see it from that perspective, you begin to feel how the impressions I call me and the impressions I call the world are completely intermixed. In fact, they are so inextricably intermixed that you begin to be unable to say that they are actually two separate classes of phenomena. The aftermath exactly, in the ongoing effect of such careful study of the self, the world changes. And this too solid flesh doesn't look so solid anymore. And then we may feel like, oh, I'm hardly here at all. That's actually a kind of low drama liberation.
Yeah.
we might say we prefer we'd like a higher drama liberation, please. A little more fireworks. But we also find that that's not actually at our direction. And that liberation that the only liberation that has actual integrity is as uniquely ours as it is universal. So it's perhaps tempting mistake to look at some other liberation, somebody else's, Shakyamuni Buddha's, for instance, and kind of wish for that. Oh, I'd like that liberation. That one over there. That'd be a good one. Like, well, it doesn't work that way. Dogen reminds us, actually, liberation is neither general nor particular. And he equates that, what does he say? He says, it's actually inseparable from effort without desire. And that's, there's one thing that's kind of the hallmark of practice in this lineage. It's something like that, effort without desire. Effort that kind of moves steadily and respectfully through the stickiness of the self. You may have noticed the self is extremely sticky. We tend to go through the world as though we were covered with molasses. Everything that flies by sticks to us. There's that great scene at the end of that movie, Brazil, which I love that movie, where the unfortunate hero gets kind of buried in all these newspapers. The wind's blowing and they all stick to him. And then finally the newspapers blow away and there's nobody there. This is kind of how it is. The stuff that we think represents us in the world is like the newspapers sticking. And inside, there's just wind. Wind of karma. So that's what it means to say that we're kind of hardly there. It's not the same as saying we're not there. That would probably also be a mistake. But the way that we're there is extremely important to become familiar with. Dogen quotes Master Xuefeng, famous Tang Dynasty lunatic, who said, the great earth is the gate of emancipation. Even if I invite people, they won't go through it. Dogen says, it's true, the great earth is the gate of emancipation. But going in and out of that gate is not easy, he says. He says, you might invite people, and then they might miss it. Or you might not invite people, and they get stuck. He said, if you have a gate that accepts people. Then they can go in and out. So fortunately, the gate of liberation is one that accepts people without distinction. And it's not other than or anywhere else than this great earth and all its people and beings and so forth. As Master Zhaozhou said, horses cross, donkeys cross. So whether we think we are a horse, which in the Chinese frame of reference is kind of a noble beast, or a donkey, who is kind of a doofus, all can cross. That's the gate of acceptance. And that's the gate of hardly there at all. But because of the stickiness of the self, we seem to have to generate this effort without desire. Because otherwise it's very hard to see. You know, we keep looking for gates that either come with an invitation or with a denial. We don't realize the gate is always open. So we get hung up either about being accepted or being denied. So to counteract that momentum, we're told, well, why don't you just sit where you are and periodically somebody may dangle a little carrot in front of you, give you a little something to reach for, and then this being Zen, as soon as you reach for it, they'll take it away, hopefully leaving you at least briefly in a space of effort without desire, because the carrot's gone. But you're still kind of, you're still kind of upright. So Dogen says, you know, it's not easy going in and out. And I was thinking, well, why would somebody come out? I mean, go in, yeah, but come out? Why does he say go in and out? Well, he doesn't elaborate on that particular point, but my thought was, well, sometimes when we go in, you know, the world can kind of vanish. And it's like, well, that's okay, but then how are you going to benefit beings if you're in a space where there aren't any? So kind of come out and help transform beings. Then maybe go in, come out, go in, come out. This is how the so-called gateless gate works. Horses cross, donkeys cross, and nobody actually goes anywhere. So this could also start to sound like, you know, Hamlet again. It's like, well, nobody's ever getting anywhere. This is terrible. That's the sort of samadhi of self-absorption. I'm not getting anywhere. Yeah, it's another samadhi, also called not getting anywhere, which doesn't have that baggage. That's what Dogen calls the samadhi of self-fulfillment. the self-fulfilling samadhi. Samadhi of, I'm kind of hardly here. So that's kind of how our teaching works. And Larry was showing me something this morning. I forget William James' expression, something about the, what was it, the delirium of contradiction? No, the delight of, anyway, something about mysticism delighting in these kinds of contradictory presentations. And boy, we got that in Zen, all right. One and many, and gates and no gates, and self and not self, and form and emptiness. Because that's in fact how we work. It's not exactly a contradiction. It's the Chinese, of course, presented it more as a dynamism between dark and light, motion and stillness, and so forth. And because that is the dynamic of the universe, of heaven and earth, that's how we function. We wouldn't expect to do something totally different. That'd be a little odd. Chinese expression, you know, there's the Tao, the great, indivisible being, indivisible reality that functions dynamically, light giving way to dark, giving way to light over and over again. This is exactly our practice. And eventually, the self begins to be revealed as light giving way to dark, giving way to light, over and over and over again. So as Dogen says in his verses on Awakening the Way, you have gained the pivotal opportunity of human form. You have gained the world, which is itself the gate of liberation. So don't waste time. And another way to say that is, don't worry. I don't know about you guys, but I'm a dedicated and gifted worrier. So the advice about not worrying was quite helpful to me, because it's very easy to start fretting about, even about Dharma. It's like, well, isn't there enough to fret about? Do I have to fret about Dharma too? It's like, no, don't do that. Dharma's about, don't fret. Just be still. And study the self, and your own experience will convince you. That is your unique and also universal liberation. Eventually, we'll be in some circumstances where the pressure is kind of cranked up for various reasons. Sometimes maybe because things are not going very well, and other times because things are going kind of too well. In either case, the pressure of the two solid flesh, its apparent weight, they seem to ramp up. So it's good to have some experience of practicing in a more kind of a little bit more neutral circumstance. Which is why we're usually told, well, you know what, don't wait till you're like dying to start practicing, because that's okay, but that's really hard, because the pressure is going to go up. And you will be very, very tempted, as they metaphorically express it, particularly in Tibetan Buddhism, you'll be tempted to flee into various realms of existence rather than abide in the clear light. You'll be tempted to flee into one of the other realms. So you can get away from light, giving way to dark, giving way to light over and over again. So when they say don't waste time, they just mean don't wait till the pressure's way up. You know, start doing the study of the self when the pressure isn't so bad. And that way, as the pressure increases, your uprightness will be there to meet it. And even if, you know, the pressure could be like really severe, like it could be very, very ill or injured or something like that. Even if that's the case, just, you know, one moment of the Dharma teaching can illuminate those clouds of suffering in quite a remarkable way. Just some little seemingly irrelevant event can remind us of our own uprightness. It can remind us where the gate of liberation actually is. So I try to live in this truth and don't always do so well, and depend completely on you guys for help. This is the Sangha, that's what it's for. So I very much appreciate your own patience and effort. And when I fall down, maybe you can give me a hand up, and then when you fall down, I can give you a hand up. And then eventually, of course, we'll all fall down. And we can be like the late abbot Zin Chin used to say in his poem about, we can conk out among the busted spring rain cherry blossom wine jars. That's kind of how it is. Perhaps you have some question or comment. Yeah.
Reverend Meal, thank you for your teaching. You alluded to this a little bit, and I wondered if you might expand. From my personal view, I see myself often as invisible or inconsequential. Mm. So it's not the, gosh, it's this big self walking around. It's just like Mr. Selfie.
Uh-huh.
So I wonder if you could talk about that and how to deal with those feelings.
Well, we are kind of inconsequential, and there's a kind of an emotional freight with that, which comes from our attachment to the presumed self. So the place to study that is exactly in the middle of that arising. Oh, and especially in this neighborhood, you know, at my age, you're kind of inconsequential. So that I notice that a lot, and then I notice, oh look, I kind of don't like that. Now how about if I don't go anywhere with it, stay there, don't try to get away, don't try to flee into some other realm, just stay there as it arises and watch light become light. And then I'll notice there's actually nothing solid there happening. There's a habit of thought, and that's about it. And then to see that over and over again makes the emotional impact less and less and less until it's hardly a blip. And that's kind of the secret, if you like, of our study, is to study right there in that moment when I'm feeling like ignored again. And the, you know, the guy in front of me at Starbucks, you know, is like really cute. And the barista's like, oh, hi, how are you today? You know, what would you like? You know, and I got there and they're like, next. Okay, here we go again. So, and then that stuff will start to churn. It's like, okay, don't go anywhere. Stay right there in the midst of this slightly warm space and watch what happens. And then the liberative side of that experience presents itself. It may take us a little while to appreciate, but it is there. That I'm convinced of. So it's not exactly a remedy, but it's how to use that those phenomena, that experience, in that moment, to turn it in the direction of liberation rather than towards more bondage. It's something to try.
When you started speaking, I very much could relate to what you were, the idea you were starting out with, the idea that you realized you weren't there, really, until I realized I misunderstood you completely. Because what resonated initially, what I identified with, what I thought I understood in your initial words was that the feeling I sometimes have, and I guess we all have, that we are nowhere. That with time, hard periods of our life, be it a minute or an hour, passes without us even noticing. It's like we go into a trance, we fall asleep, and then where was I? And that, of course, and I was thinking about that as you spoke, and I thought, well, that seems to be it. What does that mean? And maybe you could speak of that a bit, but what struck me was is that because I was so there, I was nowhere. I was so there in my own mind, so there in the emotions, the feelings, maybe it's worry, maybe it's distraction, maybe it's boredom, that it feels like I'm nowhere, but in fact I'm just in my head. And that's something different, I mean, kind of like almost maybe the polar opposite.
Well, I think particularly in sitting, we encounter that a lot, and there's a very strong temptation to kind of keep track of how many times I was, quote, not there, and then see, was that better than yesterday or worse? But the fact of the matter is, there isn't anywhere else to be. So if, retrospectively, we think that, well, that moment back then, I wasn't kind of really appreciating that. It's like, well, it's okay to have that thought, but I wouldn't spend any time there trying to figure that out. Where was I? Was that good or bad? I would say start afresh in that instant. Never mind what went before. Because there isn't anywhere else to be. So you weren't somewhere else. You may have not been attending to things in a certain lively, present way. But never mind that. Start again in that instant. This is part of effort without desire. Presenting our practice to the universe, our bodhisattva vow to the universe over and over again without keeping score. Because eventually our scorecard will be like as big as the Empire State Building. And we're just tottering around with this thing, trying to wait, was that better than yesterday or not so good? No, how about last month? It's like, forget all that stuff. It's irrelevant. What is relevant is, what about now? Whether I'm on my cushion, or in my car, or out the street, what about now? This is entering the world over and over again as the gate of emancipation. rather than being dogged by the past or what we think we were doing or how we thought we were accomplishing our practice. Just never mind. So I don't know if that makes any sense to you, but when I said I had this notion, oh, I'm hardly there, I was actually very there, you might say. And that was what revealed the fluid, shifting, shimmering quality of being in that moment. And I think I was between Dolores and church, next to the cathedral there. And I don't recall thinking, well, where was I when I was crossing the street? It's like, maybe I thought that, but if so, I think I just, it doesn't matter. What matters is what's happening now. And so try not to drag the past around with us and start, if you like, at zero over and over and over again without any, getting hung up on regret or wish for better times or any of that. Just let that go. Enter the moment again and again and again. Yes?
Well, I had way far too many moments of, you know, feeling comments arising to you know, go back over and over. But that idea of effort without work.
Desire?
Effort without desire. To me, that's kind of closely linked with some idea of progress, which is like it's really hard for us to, you know, it's hard for us to kind of detach or, you know, just kind of like let go of that, you know, of our kind of evaluating mind all the time, kind of trying to measure, you know, measure this concept, whatever it means to us.
Yeah.
But I remember thinking years ago about the, wondering about the idea of devotion without an object. Which to me is kind of the same thing,
mm-hmm.
And you know, so and what would that be, and how is that expressed? And you know, I've been studying it ever since, and
mm-hmm.
It's very interesting,
mm-hmm.
You know, to just you know, like how do you express devotion if it has no particular object?
Mm-hmm.
And this arose as a result of a conversation that I was in with a person at Green Gulch who, you know, was a very active environmentalist. And he wanted to make his home there and just kind of like take off on all these projects. And he
yeah.
said, and he and his girlfriend were just looking for a place to be devoted to. And I thought, oh, a place.
Yes.
That's interesting. You know, I mean, what would this devotion look like
mm-hmm.
if it was just devotion?
Yeah.
And it wasn't about some particular place or thing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yes, I think that. That is the echo of effort without desire. That's right. And if you're just devoted, does that express itself in everything you do, everywhere you go, everyone you meet? That'd be pretty cool.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Not so easy, maybe, but
right.
Pretty cool.
Exactly.
And at its best, you know, Soto Zen practice also has a kind of worst side, but at its best, it kind of looks like that. People expressing devotion as actual individual acts, but without any particular freight on any particular act. All the acts of the day have this quality of presence and care without being, you know, leveraging anything. It doesn't always look like that, of course.
And here, too, you can also get hung up on the idea of progress. I mean,
yeah.
It's kind of like, it's kind of a loaded thing, because you
yes.
know, you can be just very carried away with self-evaluation all the time. You know?
Yeah.
But what's kind of cool is that, you know, just the idea of noticing, you know, noticing if it's possible to do that without being too self-judgmental, just the, you know, the possibility of practice being no more than a series of moments of noticing.
Yes.
You know, how it works.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And,
right.
Try trying to hold yourself to some kind of standard.
Some kind of standard, right. And of course, that kind of noticing is given a boost by simplifying stuff by sitting still and not doing much of anything. That kind of sharpens our noticing ability so that when things are more complicated and active, we're actually more able to move with those fluctuations. Without, it's like, what? Are you saying you don't actually have to sit? And I'm kind of saying, yeah, actually you don't. But I do. I need that particular style of effort without desire. Maybe everybody else doesn't necessarily. Yeah.
Is that what's meant by green mountains walking?
Is what?
The,
what's meant by green mountains walking?
By the space changing and
yeah,
like
kind of.
Sitting leading to devotion.
Yeah. Green mountains walking is also another way of saying, oh, we're hardly there at all. What's there is mountains walking. And sometimes I call that me. Sometimes I call that mountains. But that's what's happening. Is that?
We were at Krishna Das on Thursday night. As he spoke of practice, as you're speaking of this crossing in and out, and over time, being hardly there, the phrase that he used was eventually and inevitably.
Mm.
So we take on our practice, we take on our devotion, and live with that, and live it, that eventually and inevitably, this begins to occur.
Mm-hmm.
So it's the process, the doing, the being it, that is the thing, rather than sort of checking it off on the list or getting somewhere.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, I think eventually and inevitably is, you know, as good a way as any of describing the Bodhisattva vow. It hinges on that eventuality and inevitability. And so maybe it's not so important if when we say the Bodhisattva vow, partly we're thinking, well, this is ridiculous. How am I going to save all beings? Like, well, never mind. That's not how it works. We may try to have a full moon ceremony Wednesday if some of you are around. It's kind of unfortunate because that's also a study night, but doing them both seems like an overkill. So we might just have to have full moon on Wednesday. Eventually we will finish transmission of the light. Eventually we will. We're actually getting there. And you're all invited. You don't have to have been reading it right along. That's most, I don't know about most, but some Wednesdays at 7 p.m. we have an hour of study. You're always invited.
And we have books to share.
And we have books to share.
7:30.
7. We've switched it. That way people can come for Zazen and then not escape.